You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck. It's another Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Thursday. Broadcasting closer to the industriously ravaged Gowanus Canal than ever before in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a throwback Michael interview with Maria Hanoun and Sophie Spahn called When Europe Loved Islam, on the history of Muslims and Islam in Europe. Also on the program today, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon arrested on fraud charges in border wall fundraising scheme. Those are the people you least expect. Barack Obama assails Trump, asks us not to let him take our democracy away. In California, fires threaten 25,000 structures as the state runs low on firefighter personnel, given the prison population they typically use is dealing with COVID lockdowns. Trump calls QAnon people that love our country, by which he, of course, means people that support him. Trump also calls for a boycott of Goodyear for not being supportive enough. Facebook, who's more balanced than Goodyear is, removes hundreds of both QAnon and Antifa pages. Also, Utah Black Lives Matter protesters facing an outrageous possible life sentence for splashing red paint and broken windows. Also, as reports surface that Postmaster Louis DeJoy wants to kneecap postal banking by filling post offices with ATMs, it turns out his appointment was pushed by Steve Mnuchin, so not this apolitical appointment that some people might want you to think. And finally, Bibi Netanyahu learns how jealousy can loom in any opened relationship, feeling the pangs now that the U.S. and U of A have normalized relations, and Jared Kushner wants to sell F-35 combat jets to the UAE. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Brendan?
Matt, how you doing?
Doing all right. This is the fourth Michael Throwback Thursday we've done. It's good to be with you again. It's crazy how time kind of marches on, but I also wanted to mention there's a lot of activity going on in Bolivia. It looks like there's some negotiations going on between MAS and the Inez coup government, which has also called for the locking up of resistance leadership for participating in protests. So Michael would have also wanted me to put that in the headlines. Anyway, now that I finally finished the headlines proper to a Michael day, Brendan, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Matt. We got a beautiful day here in Brooklyn, and I think the rhythm and timing of your headlines has only gotten better and stronger in these 4 weeks.
Well, you know, only can go up, I think, so I appreciate that. My facial hair has gotten a little bit worse. I realized I forgot to shave today, as if it was a Sam day, so don't judge me too much, folks. But all that aside, we are going to get right to the interview today. This is another one from my first year of producing Majority Report, and it's with Maria Hanoun and Sophie Spahn, two academics who wrote an article, When Europe Loved Islam and Foreign Policy, I believe. And the thing about what I liked about Michael and what I got from Michael that I don't think you can get elsewhere on the left is an understanding of the new atheist movement. I came from new atheists. You know, Christopher Hitchens was the first sort of big essay collection in politics I ever read. But you kind of soon learn the limitations of the new atheist type of let's look at what these, you know, horrible Muslims are doing now type of approach that a lot of people like to do. And Michael had, you know, like a more material, historically grounded analysis about that wasn't ideological. Anyway, this is a good example of Michael's sort of well-rounded approach to these things. It's a wide-ranging interview on the influence of Islam in Europe before, you know, our modern times of, you know, how we think of it as an invader. Actually the aristocrats embraced it to a certain extent too. But so this is from May 10th, 2016. And Michael does this joint interview with Maria Hanoun and Sophie Spann. And I just want to say before we go to that, join themajorityreport.com, become a member of this show, keep us sustained. It's tough out there if you're dealing with COVID stresses, obviously. That's not for you. But if you're doing all right, join the majorityreport.com and enjoy this interview Michael did.
I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is, Maria Hanoun. She is a PhD student at Georgetown University. And Sophie Spann, she is a PhD candidate at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. They are both studying Islamic and Arabic studies at their respective. When Europe loved Islam. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Sophie, I want to start with you, but I'm going to go to both of you on this before we get to your article. There is a very powerful public discourse now on Islam, and it comes through a number of filters. Often on this show, we talk about Islam and Middle East issues, I would say, through primarily a policy lens that is informed by history, culture. There's also a predominant discourse, which is very trendy right now and very popular in sort of the world of Reddit and online, that kind of reduces Islam and religion generally to some sort of scientific proposition that is correct or not. And of course, you know, scientifically it's not correct. So therefore, you know, Islam or Christianity or whatever is quote unquote wrong. I want to know from the perspective of somebody who actually studies this academically and historically, what is the mechanism through which you study Islam as an academic and an actual expert in the field? Sophie, I'm starting with you, but Maria, I want you to jump in right after.
Well, I think that if you study any sort of topic academically or more in depth, you'll find that everything is more complicated than it seems, and that there are different facets to a story, and that you can also not, you know, there are many different types of Islam, there are many different types of religion. It's really hard to generalize too much. Besides that, I mean, I was trained originally as a historian, and I'm researching a very sort of a very historical project. So I'm approaching it in that way as well. So in a specific context, specific time, specific actors, mm-hmm. That would be, I think, my perspective on that.
Yeah, and just to echo what Sophie's saying, I mean, I think that the study of Islam, Islamic studies could mean so many things. So for some people, for some of my colleagues, that means studying Islamic law and the centuries of legal tradition that have developed around Islam. For some people, it's looking at practice, how those laws have been applied in practice. For some people, it is looking at the Quran and how the Quran is constructed and trying to understand the language. And for us, you know, we're both more historians. We study intellectual history. And so we look at people who think about how Islam, you know, is enacted in society through different kinds of political movements, through writing, through literature, and in society with the construction of Islamic institutions. And so to deny that Islam should be kind of engaged with is to deny, you know, centuries of history and a whole, you know, many facets of society.
So you're saying that to complete any, not just a PhD, but any type of academic course of study in these subject matters, you couldn't say, as an example, my thesis is Islam is bad ideas, supporting evidence, Richard Dawkins tweet, and other guy who doesn't have training in Islam with some selected quotes. That wouldn't work?
I probably wouldn't pass my dissertation.
You would make it to the doctorate that way.
Whoa. All right. Well, I guess we're all just regressive apologists, but I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way before we jump into this. So this is fascinating. And Maria, I'll start with you this time. Okay. This piece is When Europe Loved Islam. And there's two different tracks to this conversation. There's a political track and a cultural track. We're going to start culturally.
Great.
In the 1920s, you paint a picture of in Berlin and other, you know, important, intellectually rigorous and open European capitals and major cities of interest in Islam as something that is totally outside of discourse today, something more analogous to like the way some people might look at Buddhism, actually, as a religion that is more compatible with the modern world, that is more adaptive and responsive to present and modern conditions, and in reaction to a sort of exhaustion with Christianity and modernist projects in Europe at the time. How did Islam start to play that role in Europe in the 1920s, and then specifically, just start with that, and then I'll go to Sophie. Go ahead.
One of the major trends we look at are the kind of movement of people and ideas through empire. And so in this period after World War I, there was a large influx of Muslims into some of these European capitals. There were many scholars, Muslim scholars, immigrants, travelers. And among these were the Ahmadiyya missionaries. Mm-hmm. So these are missionaries from the Punjab region of British India. And they constructed mosques, and they were very effective missionaries. And so one of the places we look at and is sort of central to our article is the Wilmersdorf Mosque in Berlin. And you see it happening there, where there's this frustration with European sort of Christian society in the wake of World War I. There's a lot of confusion, a lot of disillusionment with modernity and with the past. And so through the Ahmadiyya missions, kind of, you can see them tapping into this with their lectures on Islam and modernism and the future and the future of humanity. And so I think that it was just a kind of active and very interesting intellectual climate at this time.
So Sophie, to be clear though, that this mission, this, and I want you to get more into the specifics of it, and also this idea that was popular at the time across the spectrum of political thought in Europe of this notion of the new man. Fascists talked about it, socialists talked about it. But that this group from the Punjab was not saying, they weren't coming to Germany and saying the modern world is fallen and corrupted and we need to recreate some fantasized version of the 7th century. They were saying that Islam has a particular insight on how to modernize, which actually in some ways in that context was more egalitarian. There was a strong anti-racist bent. We won't get into this, but also this mission also was in the United States at this time and gained popularity with African Americans because of an anti-racist message. Get into the specifics of what they were saying and how it fit into a specific response to modernity.
Well, first of all, it was a context where in Berlin at that time, there was a space for a lot of sort of people, who activists, students who wanted to act against, Muslim students, activists wanted to act against British and French imperialism. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there was a bohemian site for them to come together. And the Ahmadiyya were not the only Muslim actors in Berlin at this time. There were different groups, but they were a very important one, and they were a group with a mosque. Mm-hmm. And their sort of vision of modernity was also linked to the First World War and the devastating effect that had had on Europe and specifically on Germany. So there were many people who felt disillusioned, who felt just disappointed and almost as if Christianity had failed and the war had been a result. So there was a space for these kind of new ideas, and there was a lot of interest in different types of spiritualism, not just Islam, but many, different outlets for these sort of feelings. And the Ahmadiyya were very much trying to promote a very rational, modern, progressive Islam. And that's what they wrote about. And they did this, of course, also to gain converts. But, they felt that this was something that would resonate with all these European intellectuals, which it did. But they had a sort of a really an intellectual conversation there in the Wilmersdorf Mosque with people from all different backgrounds. So that's what they tapped into. And their magazines, you know, in the one in Berlin and also in Woking, and they published also from British India, you know, this, they had a very wide reach. And these magazines were read in many different places all over Europe and also in the Muslim world. They were also kind of a controversial movement in a way, but at this time these sort of identities were quite fluid, and they did have a conversation in the 20s with a lot of different people.
Maria, I want you to talk specifically to this concept of the new man and how these Islamic movements responded to it and put their own specific spin on it.
Yeah, so one thing we talk about in our piece is just how the new man was this sort of philosophical concept that was quite trendy at this time. And it really focused on the individual. And we see it in even Nietzsche's Ubermann as this person who would be kind of excel in society or a leader. And then in the case of Hugo Marcus, who was one of the important converts in Berlin at this time, and he was actually a gay Jewish philosopher, and he was engaging with all of these people, Spinoza and Kant and Nietzsche and Goethe. And for him, the new man, this sort of utopian ideal of the human being, what was found in Islam. And so he kind of looked at the trajectory of monotheism through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and saw in Islam the sort of logical conclusion or progression of these monotheisms. And therefore, Islam became the kind of spiritual foundation for the society in which this new man would be, or this sort of ideal man of the future would be constructed. And in his other writings, he really focuses on the kind of progressive and intellectual message of Islam. So another piece that I read by him, he talks about the hadith or sayings of the prophet, and he uses the fact that these sayings were recorded and passed down through generations to show that in the East, sort of interiority and the individual were so important for such a long time. And this is a relatively new concept in Europe. So he kind of is really focusing on the philosophical, individualist, and very sort of modern message of Islam.
So, Sophie, I can already hear the kind of heads exploding over that sort of comment that there was this sense of interiority in Islam and in the East. Now, I think obviously there are distinctions, and we have to sort of draw differentiations, and there are different models of government and different ways, you know, people were individuated in politics and religion for that matter. But we have no discourse and understanding of that for most people. When you hear the idea that there was individuality in Islam, people would either have no reference point for it, or they would say that you're making some type of, you know, kind of like postmodern working backwards apology and making up something, projecting backwards into something that wasn't there to begin with. So can you give us more specifics in terms of what that individuality looked like and how it was retrieved and used in these conversations in the 20s in Europe?
Well, see, in this specific context, there were, you know, they were very much trying to be part of Europe. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to approach Europe in a way. Look, there were many different sort of Islam reformist movements.
Absolutely.
At this time, also in the 19th century. So this was not like a completely new idea, but people were conceptualizing new ideas and looking in the Quran and looking in different places to find like ideas of how Islam would be completely aligned with new technologies and all these kind of things. That was already before. And the Ahmadiyya really were trying to show people in Europe, like, you know, you can be European and you can be Muslim. And there's no, the one doesn't exclude the other. So, and someone like Hugo Marcus is also interesting because he looks at Islam not necessarily through a genealogy of Islamic philosophers and Islamic scholars, but he looks very much at Islam through this idea of all these European philosophers, which is, you know, kind of turning that whole idea around as well and going further into you know, showing that European side in a way, rather than only looking towards the East. But then other people did other things. So there's a huge variation as well in the way that people were approaching these intellectual conversations. But they always, there was this really this idea that we're looking towards the future and we're taking some texts and we're taking ideas and we're trying to create the best future in Europe. And that would have included Islam in that way.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, the individual and the individual's relationship with society was such an important question in the post-war, World War One and sort of interwar period. And so, and I mean, we even see it earlier in the history of kind of European philosophy. And so tapping into that, I think the Ahmadiyya mission really was tapping into those questions as well and kind of looking at how Islam could help facilitate or explain how the individual functions in society and as part of this modern society.
Okay, so let's move to the political track. You make another sort of interesting historical point here, and there's two sides of it, both of which we'll get to. That first of all, at this time in history, the European governments were pretty partial towards Muslims in some respects, and partial towards them as kind of like people that they wanted to be local partners in colonial enterprises. As an example, there was seemed to be certainly preferential treatment for Muslims versus Jews, as an example, in certain fighting regiments for European colonial powers. And then the other aspect was that the European powers were sort of anticipating and seeing that Islam was going to be utilized in anti-colonial struggles. So there's kind of a dual track that are connected here. But Maria, start by explaining how European governments, very specifically in this period of time, empowered Islam, built mosques. I mean, now there's a debate on banning minarets and, you know, banning Islamic symbols in many European countries. This was a time when the public coffers were used to build and subsidize Islam.
So this is definitely, Sophie can speak more to this, but in the wake of World War One, there was such a, during World War One, we see the colonial powers, France and Britain, using their Muslim soldiers and trying to court the favor of Muslim citizens in the colonies. I mean, a large percentage of their colonial subjects were Muslim. And so trying to kind of gain favor with these populations in the sort of global power struggle at the time, but then also having Muslims serve in the army in World War One was a big part of these two great powers' agenda. And so we do see some preferential treatment towards Muslims that we talk about in our piece, which is quite interesting. So these regiments would have imams within them, embedded within the regiments. And instead of pork and wine, they were given couscous and coffee and mint tea. So they were being sort of favored in this way, in a way that Jewish troops, for example, were not. In terms of the mosque, we talk about the Paris Mosque, which was built in the 1920s in the wake of World War One, and ostensibly to honor the Muslim soldiers who had served in World War One, and that angered a lot of the country's Catholics, who saw it as sort of a perversion of laïcité, or the secularism that France was supposedly adhering to. And Sophie can talk more about this. I mean, it was quite an interesting period in France's history.
Yes, Sophie, go ahead.
Well, I think in general that this definitely the Muslim soldiers who fought in the First World War is also one of these really parts of history that seems to be forgotten by a lot of people, not only on the within the Middle East, but also in Europe. There were many soldiers. Britain sent almost 140,000 Indian troops to the Western Front. Many of them were Muslim, because a lot of them came from later Pakistan. Mm-hmm. France also deployed about 500,000 colonial subjects on European battlefields, of whom also many were Muslim. And these are things that, that are important to remember. It was also the first time that there was such a big presence of Muslims on on European soil in that way. And they had special treatment in these regiments, and there was very specifically also propaganda. During the First World War, the Germans opened a POW camp in Wunsdorf, where they built a mosque and where they tried to convince soldiers, Muslim soldiers that they captured, to join their side. So in response, France also built a mosque for their soldiers. So there was kind of this propaganda battle going on. And what Germany was really trying to accomplish was trying to get Muslims in France and Britain's colonies to rise up against them, which they saw as, a good tool for them to hurt these other countries. But in the end, there was no such real, that didn't really happen. Mm-hmm. But that's an important part of history that also shouldn't be forgotten. And the Mosquée de Paris was opened in 1926, really with this idea to honor these soldiers. But in effect, what ended up happening was that mostly it was targeted at elite North Africans and French tourists in a way, as it is today. You can still go there and, drink a mint tea and buy a rug. It was very much people were, the North Africans who were working in Paris, they were not living in the same areas, and they were definitely not making enough money to go visit the hammam there or go to the restaurant. Right. And their factory times didn't align with the mosque. So it was clearly sort of a colonial power show.
Right. Sophie, continuing with you, then there's this other track where colonial powers are also anticipating that Islamic politics is starting to emerge. And again, I think this is important. I'd like you both to speak on this to kind of distinguish. When people hear Islamic politics today, and justifiably, frankly, from public media consumption, you think on one end of obviously what's associated with the sort of horrific terrorism of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. You might think of Iran, which there's a much more complicated history there. But these are specific tracks that involve terrorism, that involved sort of, more on the right side of the political spectrum in some respects. But at this time, Islam was emerging as the same way that, Indians might be re-embracing Hinduism, or people in, Ceylon or Thailand were re-engineering Buddhism in certain ways and actually doing a similar project with Buddhism. And there was Western interest in Buddhism being a kind of modern rational project, and but also reinventing all native traditions in the arsenal to reverse colonialism. There's nothing specific or special about Islam in that regard. And so the Europeans are also seeing that this religion can be an ally and a tool of colonial holding, essentially, or it can be flipped back in their face. So they're trying to anticipate that as well. And then through this conversation, we'll see some parallels in policy towards Muslims today.
Well, yeah, in this period, this fear of pan-Islam, which was also a bit older, that just didn't emerge after the First World War, but had a lot to do with colonial anxiety. And you get these independent movements, for instance, in France, that are very much that link independence also to Islam. So fear about it has a lot to do with that. And there were a lot of tools of control in this sense. The French authorities kept a really close eye on all these different organizations and through different organs, like, for instance, a sort of not a trade union, but an area where they would go to get work in an office. And there would always be, intelligence. People would be watching them because, Islam was almost also a tool of control in that way. And it's hard to compare, I understand why, but it's still a bit difficult to compare to the situation today. Again, these colonial empires were so big and had such a big influence on politics and policy, and we don't really have that right now, not in the same way. Mm-hmm. But
I guess there is some terrible. Yeah, there's this sort of idea of when you fear something, you can take steps to control it. And I think in a way we see that today with the kind of movement towards having something called, and I put this in kind of scare quotes, British or European Islam, as if there can be an Islam engineered in Europe that's Europe friendly and friendly to the kind of public and society of Europe, or, and that involves training imams in the Netherlands and in France and sort of state-sponsored training of imams. And all of these kind of ideas are, they reflect a similar mentality, which is maybe their government's resting control over something that they fear or don't understand. And I think we see it today, and we also saw it in that period, though it looks very different, and maybe the entities being feared are very different.
Right. That was actually that's the parallel I was looking for, Maria, and I want you to expand on that, because, you know, I think it's important to be fair and be rigorous in this conversation that there is, okay, so one of the important sort of things that you guys both note in your article is that the discourse on Islam in Europe today is, the frame is wrong, because Islam is not new to Europe. And there is this very broad and deep and textured history here that involves the colonial experience, that involves migration, that involves all of these countercultural movements and anti-colonial movements and everything else. But at the same time, in Europe today, you have a challenge where all of these things are sort of happening concurrently. You have the rise of the right. You have tremendous bigotry and xenophobia and everything else that is expressed towards Muslims and people coming from the Middle East or North Africa. And then you also do have, you know, in fact, we can be quite clear, I think, you know, the distinction between an Islamic-inspired anti-colonial politics versus a, you know, why would someone be drawn to joining ISIS? That's an entirely different sort of conversation. But we can also acknowledge, I guess, to be real here, that there are legitimate security concerns, and there are legitimate conversations about balancing multiculturalism and national identity and everything else. And so I guess what I'm curious about is, what do you both see, and Maria, I'll start with you, from this research and from being grounded in this history, that can at least start to get us to ask the right questions and have the right sort of frame so we can start dealing with these challenges more intelligently now?
Oh, big question.
Always a big question.
So I think one thing that, for me, this research really illuminates is that not only is Islam not new to Europe, but the relationship between Europe and all of these different kinds of Islam and Muslims and converts is so complex, and sort of thinking about the past, we see some trends that are still helpful in explaining things today. And so one of those trends is this kind of otherizing of Islam and sort of state, the relationship between Islam and the state, which was never simple, never easy, and is really related to the colonial experience. And it's something that I think if we ignore this past, we're unable to truly understand Islam today. And if we start the narrative in the 70s or the 60s, we're also neglecting a really important part of history. And I think doing that makes it seem like there's this new Islam phenomenon that is occurring in a void. And obviously, we know that's not true. It's a very long and kind of compelling history. And so I just think beginning to look at a kind of both why a broader framework for understanding the relationship between Europe and Islam and Muslims in Europe and European Muslims. And I mean, in the piece, we don't even talk about Muslims in Eastern Europe, which is a totally different and really important and historic Muslim communities. But I do think that one of the problems that both of us, I'm speaking for Sophie, but have with the discourse is that it so flattens Islam and Muslim identity, and really the kind of fear of global terrorism or Al-Qaeda or ISIS really sort of drowns out other versions and expressions of Islam in society, and even political Islam. And those things are very important to engage with if we really want to understand how the world works.
And I just have to interject, Sophie, I want to get your thoughts on this, but to be really, you know, fair and upfront with some of this audience, I would just underline that I think, you know, it's one thing to have what you can call, frankly, a more high-minded intellectual commitment to do what you're talking about. But I just want to also argue from the practical perspective that even if you were to say that your prime concerns with these things were terrorism and were, you know, preserving social liberalism with, you know, migration from Islamic countries or whatever other concerns that you're kind of expressing and dealing with, these are the conversations and the groups and the complexity that you need to have in order to formulate the right solutions and the right responses. Just sitting back and, you know, not liking the Quran or quoting some people who have no idea what they're talking about is not going to do the very practical job. So I think it's important to underline that this isn't just it's not just a high-minded motivation. This is the actual work of, even if your prime interest is just counterterrorism, which is a, you know, quite an important issue. But you need to engage in all of these things in a serious and rigorous way to solve for all of the concerns that you might have from, you know, from recognizing the complexity and vitality of, a you know, over a billion people on the planet to dealing with terrorism. Sophie, go ahead.
Well, I would link to that in a way that also, if you're a policymaker, historicizing and contextualizing these issues is really important, because otherwise you might not fully understand what you're actually talking about.
Right.
And you might not have the tools to then find the right measures to do something, you know, positive. And in that way, this part of Europe, because it's European history, you know, that's what's important about it as well. It's not, even when we talk about Muslim Spain, often that's talked about as in within Islamic studies, Middle Eastern history, where you're thinking, well, actually, it's also European history. And this part in the interwar period, where there was so much, you know, conversation going on and a different engagement with Islam, is also part of European history. These mosques are in the center of these centers of these cities. Well, the Wormersdorf Mosque is, you know, in the middle of Berlin. It's very visual in that way as well. And if we don't forget this, and if we keep, you know, if we talk about it in this way and acknowledge this longer relationship, it does change the conversation that we have when, you know, today when people say, oh yeah, Muslims who came in the 60s and the 70s. Well, that's not the case. These other people were there before there, and they also had had ideas and interaction with Europeans and maybe, you know, became European in a way.
Absolutely. The piece is When Europe Loved Islam, Sophie Spahn, Maria Hanun, I appreciate your time. Both of you, thank you very much for joining us on the Majority Report.
Thanks for having us.
Right, there you are, folks. Some classic Michael pronunciation at the end there. This reminded me of, like, a year after this came out, Dunkirk, the movie, came out. And there was like a Gamergate-style conniption over... I'm getting something confused. Basically, there weren't any Muslim soldiers in the Dunkirk movie. But the truth is that there was a lot from India that, and they just weren't there. And that's what I always think about with the Gamergate controversy. Like, how dare you make this World War II about, like, a non-white European, right? Like, it's, this is actual reality, folks.
Hey, give me the history I'm comfortable with, not the actual one.
Yeah, exactly. Give me, well, this is the crazy thing about this stuff is it's people preferring the myths to the actual history.
Of course.
And it's very, and they act like they're the adults. You know, I want to learn my history from statues of guys on horses. We'll welcome Jamie and Matt here. You have something else to say there?
I just, it also reminded me of the interview we had with Gerald Horn a few weeks ago. And the relationship of, you know, Muslims in North Africa to the Spanish.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Gerald Horn is an amazingly prolific guy. Yeah, oh, 100%. I would love that. I mean, imagine if, I often think about, like, and I don't know if Gerald Horn does a lot of teaching. I don't know, imagine, like, when he would have time to. But like all these guys who both teach and write, like just to have their lectures taped and recorded and available online would be selfishly something I would love to have.
He also just seems like a very engaging professor.
Oh yeah. He's one of the best.
History professors are the best. I'm biased though.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. There's plenty of examples. Harvey Kay, of course, another one, that comes to mind, just very good. I mean, We selfishly we appreciate it because they're good at media too, and it makes our jobs a lot easier. But Jamie and Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey guys, how you doing today?
Doing okay. Doing okay.
And the gang back together again for another Thursday. My cats are both sleeping right now, so hopefully they won't cause a ruckus in the background and distract me like they usually do.
Do your cats when you're talking on the phone or maybe talking into a microphone, do they start whining at you as if you're talking to them? Like my cat gets confused. One of them gets confused and he just starts whining if I'm like on the phone to my parents or something like that.
My youngest cat whines. She doesn't even need an excuse to whine. She's just like, what are you talking about? Are you talking about food? What about me? The other one's chill.
Well, Binder, you don't have anything to add on the cat front?
I have a cat, but you know, he's just a cat.
Once you have a child, I feel like cats become just cats.
They
lose the anthropomorphic voice that they have in your head. Is that a thing that happens? I'll be very sad if that happens.
No, I do understand in my head.
It's true that I was like, you know, with my dogs or cats or whatever animal I had at the time, I always just like, yeah, they're my, like, yeah, they're more than just a pet. But when you do have kids, yes, they are. They do become just pets. I love them, but that the idea of them being your baby sort of, they're like a roommate in the house. So I like having them. I love them.
Matt. But, don't listen to that, guys. You're my babies forever, even if I ever reproduce a human.
I will say, though, speaking of cats and
Matt's
children,
that the door so his cat can't hear.
My daughter, Enid, she just turned one, and she learned how to say no. And she does say it exactly how a cat like does their howl thing. Like, you know, when they go like, ah, like she goes, no, no, it sounds
nice.
I think we've discussed this before, Matt, but your cat looks exactly like my cat.
Oh, really?
Russian
blue?
Not a Russian blue, but we thought he was. So it's possible he's part because
part.
He looks
mine's
very
part,
much
too.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's because we're sleeping exactly like Putin. Your cat. That's what Putin gave us when we came to America, this country of leftism.
He said, here's a Russian blue that people won't quite know is a Russian blue because that way they'll be undercover. They're just part, yeah?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, careful what you say around him.
So guys, there's a lot of news today. And there's one story I think we should definitely get to before we jump to the members half, because it is quite the story. I mean, I have no pleasure in reporting this, but Steve Bannon might be getting the death penalty.
Yeah,
who wants to haven't been watching since 2016? Why don't you explain what that means, Matt?
That is the classic Louise Mensch tweet where she said that she had sources who told her that Steve Bannon was being considered for the death penalty for espionage. And of course, she was pro-life and took no pleasure in reporting that. Now, I, on the other hand, do take great pleasure in reporting this. And that is Steve Bannon has been, what is it, felony fraud, basically? He was taken in by the United States Postal Service agents, which I love. That's just
fighting back.
So much greater.
And he was on a yacht when it happened.
Right. Is it a yacht or was it more like one of those like boats that you see someone living on in the beginning of a movie when they're down on their luck?
And houseboat.
Might have been more of a boat. I don't know.
Right. But it seems like that boat, I think that might be the boat that was purchased with the funds that he is being indicted on, I guess, in terms of the fraud charges. Him and three other people, one of them being the founder of the We Build That Wall project, the one where they basically raised $25 million off the backs of Trump supporters by convincing them that if Trump couldn't get the funds for his border wall through Congress, then, you know, they'll just do the obvious thing and fund it themselves, which, you know, that's how it works, right, guys? That's
individualism.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And do we have any clips for that? I think we have a few, actually. We definitely have one. The Trump.
It's like, what if mutual aid, but bad?
Right. Oh, this is Trump being asked, because this was just breaking this morning, the morning of Thursday, August 20th, 2020. And so Trump is doing his, I guess, morning conference with the press, and he gets asked this question.
The indictment of your former campaign aide, Steve Bannon.
Well, I feel very badly. I haven't been dealing with him for a long period of time, as most of the people in this room know. He was involved in our campaign. He worked for Goldman Sachs. He worked for a lot of companies, but he was involved likewise in our campaign and for a small part of the administration very early on. I haven't been dealing with him at all. I know nothing about the project other than I didn't like, when I read about it, I didn't like it. I said, this is for government. This isn't for private people. And it sounded to me like showboating, and I think I let my opinion be very strongly stated at the time. I didn't like it. It was showboating and maybe looking for funds, but you'll have to see what happens. I think it's a very sad thing for Mr.
I guess
Bannon.
I think he just rambles on and repeats himself.
It's a sad thing
it's
for Sloppy Steve.
It's not surprising whatsoever that someone who had connections with the Trump administration, was formerly part of the Trump administration, would be arrested for fraud. I mean, really, it's the most unsurprising thing.
That's a good – if you can get those odds in Vegas, you ride them.
Right. I mean,
if your money was on Corey Lewandowski – correct as the last one to get not be arrested.
Can I just talk about this organization a little bit and some of the other individuals involved in the Build the Wall pack. Steve Bannon was arrested for being involved in as chairman. Advisory board includes Eric Prince, former Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo, Sheriff Dave Clark, and former pitcher. And former pitcher, what former pitcher? We know which former pitcher it is. Do we know?
A game developer too.
The one with the video. I can't remember.
Yeah, Kurt Schilling.
Schilling. Yeah.
Yeah. Some testimonials they got from Louis Gohmert, Corey Lewandowski, Kim Guilfoyle, and Trump Jr. So I don't think you can get indicted for testimonials. But I will just say, Bannon is one thing. Eric Prince going down would be beautiful. So Godspeed to this investigation. Yeah. I hope
you guys.
I want Eric Prince.
You guys were like this. Mike Cernovich was promoting this shit, too.
Oh, I'm sure he was. I mean, listening
to the funny thing, though, one second, I got to add this one really funny thing. He was trying to fight back against all the people who were tweeting at him for being part of this. And his excuse was basically, how can I be a grifter when I keep losing money? Ask my ex-wife. You know, the one who bankrolls his entire life.
His alimony, yeah.
Yes, yes. So go ahead, Jamie. I just had to add that before we got any further.
I mean, if you're the answer to that question is, like, if you have a subsidy from, like, say, someone like that, you can afford to be bad at grifting and still grift. Like, that's that's how this country works. This is how a whole bunch of incompetent people with a subsidy from some, you know, nest egg or another, they just get to waltz through life doing the thing because they have the money to continue doing it. It's not because they're good at it.
Yeah, no.
Grifting doesn't necessarily mean success. You just take money from people. There's no added necessary addendum that requires you do good for yourself with the money.
Yeah, I mean, Trump himself has not done a very good job growing his inherited wealth. I think if he had just put it in a mutual fund or something, it would have grown much more than it did in all his stupid business deals. He's actually
Where's the fun in that, Jamie? Where's the fun in that?
You don't get to have dinner with Mike Tyson
People want to talk shit on Paris Hilton, but she's done a much better job growing her inherited wealth into some kind of little business there. Also, like, I think Trump is just pissed he didn't get a taste. Like, part of this is him being totally unafraid to throw people under the bus, but part of it is like...
He's like, I can't.
No, I know why he's throwing us under the bus. And it's true, actually. I looked this up. Now, he didn't come out and denounce the project when they were in the midst of raising funds back in what I think was like 2018. I couldn't find anything where he said anything about the project then.
Right.
But a few months ago, he did denounce the project, and here's why. Remember when there was that bit of information in the news, that news story, that a piece of the border wall in Texas had fallen over? Oh, yeah. That was not actually Trump's border wall. That was whatever little piece of border wall these guys put up. So they made Trump look bad in the news, and that's why he had to come out and say.
No.
He even said when he denounced it, I think this is a bunch of people trying to make me look bad. If you look at the people who funded this thing, it's all of his most biggest supporters. These guys love him. I mean, but you know, he had to denounce them because the number one thing, you know, the number one rule for Donald Trump is got to make me look good and or give me credit for whatever it is that's making you look good.
There's a lesson for all of us there in how, like, yes, the federal government should take care of these big projects. Obviously not the wall. Let's build a big highway for people to come in. But climate change, for instance, is not us banding together as individuals and maybe doing some donations to an NGO. The government made this problem by basically creating the fossil fuel industry as the demon it is today. It needs to fix it. So,
are you saying the government needs to fix immigration too, Matt?
In the sense that we need no borders and everyone can just go everywhere, right?
That's right. That's right. Do we have the video of Don Jr.?
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah.
All right. Yeah, these guys must really hate Trump, right?
And thank you guys for being here. Brian, thank you so much for all your sacrifices, doing this and showing really what capitalism's all about, right? This is private enterprise at its finest, doing it better, faster, cheaper than anything else. And what you guys are doing is pretty amazing. It started from a grassroots effort. And it's just doing some wonderful things for an important issue.
Right, there that's you what go. Capitalism's
Someone's
all
sleeping
about.
In the basement tonight.
Wow.
I just feel like his dad can make him sleep in the basement anytime he's embarrassed him.
I've never seen a group of people who hate me more than that clip right there.
You know, it is a perfect example of capitalism at work, I must say. Don Jr. is right about that. You know, you have this tiny group of elite parasites sucking the resources of regular people or, you know, small business tyrants who own Ski-Doo dealerships or whoever donated to this thing solely for their own benefit. And yes, the project they were doing would also not have benefited the public. So it's one of those rare cases where we don't have to feel bad for anyone.
Yeah. There's one more cherry on top to close this story that I just saw. And that is that the boat that was purchased with the funds sent to this nonprofit or this PAC, whatever it is, to fund the wall, that boat took part in one of the big boater parades for Trump that he was boasting.
Oh, nice.
Of course. Hey, you got your fleet. You know, you have to move
that's
ships
a business,
around.
That's a write-off then, isn't it?
It's the circle of grift. Like this whole thing was so perfectly, it was like I put a bow on it. It's like a perfect circle.
Yeah. I mean, Alex Perrine had an article like years ago. I mean, in the past like couple of years, but on like how basically the party's just grifters now. That the long lucrative right wing grift is blowing up in the world's face. Yeah, that's the there you go.
I think I speak for most prison abolitionists when I say the story has me feeling some very complicated feelings.
All right. Well, yeah, who knows what's going to happen with these guys? I'm sure they'll find a way out of it. So you won't have to really adjust your feelings much, I'm sure. I'm sure they'll find a way to get a slap on the wrist and avoid jail time. Maybe they'll have to spend a few months in their homes with a little bracelet around their ankle at most. I mean, I'm not familiar, but it doesn't seem like that much of a that far to pull in terms of just me guessing that that's going to be the...
You're probably right.
Hopefully.
The carceral state is not designed to go after the ruling class, folks. It's only designed to go after the proletariat. That's why we can't be strengthening it and funding it, because they're not putting Steve Bannon in jail.
I also want to say I just hope that... am I still... I'm still upright.
Yeah, I see you. I see you.
Okay. Sorry, now I lost my place. Go on. Let's go to the fun half. I forgot my point.
It's all good. Let me tell you how many times that happened to me when I was in your shoes, Matt.
It's weird.
A lot of
when you can't see if Zoom disappears all of a sudden, you feel like, oh, I thought it might have. And you feel like you're talking to yourself for a while anyway.
Oh, I didn't even need Zoom. I've talked about when I was in the room with Michael and Sam and dealing with some sort of tech issue. And then it was thrown to me for my opinion. And I was just like, wait, what are we talking about again? What happened? All right, let's do it. Let's go to the second half. A lot more to talk about. A lot of fun to be had. We're on the final day of this wonderful, not at all weird remote DNC. So we'll talk about it all. Join us in the fun half. Who wants to plug their stuff first? I usually go first, so I don't want to go first again. So someone else,
I will plug my stuff. So this week on the Antifada, we have the OG Antifada crew of me and Sean talking about two very topical topics, namely the USPS and the fascism. So first of all, we'd give a little history of the USPS, how it was created by a giant wildcat strike in 1970 on the part of postal workers, and how both Democrats and Republicans have been attacking it basically ever since in a bipartisan fashion, and how the Democrats shot themselves in the ass on this. Also, we talk about Ice Bay. I don't know if you guys remember her. She's got an OnlyFans now, which has actually been approved by ICE. So everyone who's horny for fascism can check out them titties online.
I mean, that's why we allow this type of media, right? Like OnlyFans, like, of course, the people porn, but for some sort of propagandistic purposes like this, of course.
Yeah. Mm. Why do you think ICE approved it? They'd much rather have people thinking about them titties than, you know, what ICE is actually doing.
They're trying to hire more ICE bays.
Pretty much. I think you have to submit a picture now with your application. leads us into a discussion on fascism. What is a fascism? Is Trump a fascism? Is America? We talk about various thinkers' attempts to define the big F. And check it out. I feel like I did a bad job describing it just now, but I'm real proud of this one. Also, I will be moderating a teach-in on anti-work politics and the welfare rights movement and how they relate to our current moment. This is a venture of my DSA caucus, Emerge, and it's going to be on Sunday at 5:00 p.m. and featuring sociologist and writer Wilson Sherwin, who is a former guest of the Antifada as well. So I put a link to that in the blog post. I encourage everyone to check it out.
Ah, Sunday is my birthday.
Oh,
felt like adding that.
I just gave you the perfect way to celebrate.
There we go. Yeah, I'm going to spend, sorry, kids.
Yeah.
Spending my birthday watching that. No, but I'm sure it'll be great.
Kids are
If I didn't have kids,
work.
I'd be, yeah, I'm sure they'll, I'm sure, they can't even sit down for pre-K via Zoom. So I doubt they'll be able to.
They understand it very intuitively before it's beaten out of them by capitalist society.
Right.
It's like swimming.
Go ahead, Matt.
TMBS on Tuesday night, we had Dustin Costello of the Teamsters to talk about the USPS and the fight to save public goods in this country, and the left's failure to come to the aid of striking TVA workers recently. That's the Tennessee Valley Authority, one of the biggest public utility in the country, one of the shining inheritances from the New Deal. And because the left wasn't there, a America Firster was trying to outsource their IT department, and some America First people came in and said, we're going to defend these workers, and Trump got his victory. And you know, we talk about the failure of the left to have been there for those workers and what we need to do going forward. So check that out, patreon.com/TMBS. And Literary Hangover, I know I promised to stream on last weekend. I will do one on tomorrow night. So look forward to that. twitch.tv/literary hangover.
Brendan, come on. I know you could think of something. Go ahead. Just promote a social media account, something, buddy.
Why we got to be in promotion all the time? We got to be more collective. I promote all your shows. I second all of them.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, Brendan.
Fine. That was very nice. But I
will take it.
I will promote my show. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can. Well, I'm going to actually promote two shows. Last week, I had an interview with the president of Media Matters on QAnon, and I'm bringing that up because QAnon is probably more so in the news now than ever before. And we spoke for over an hour about, and people have told me this, you know, they say they've watched a lot of QAnon type content that covered it, and that this conversation went places that they haven't heard before, because we didn't just focus on the conspiracy theory, we focused on what it's going to evolve into, what's to come, and basically how it's already changed. It's really a good discussion. Doomedpod.com for the audio version, or youtube.com/Matt Binder to catch the video replay. But then tonight, if you want some live stuff, I will be live streaming tonight right after the DNC. I'm going to give or take based on how the other nights ended, around 11:15 p.m. with Nomiki of the Nomiki Show. She'll be breaking down the week that was the DNC. She's been covering it, you know, every single day, so nobody knows what's going on at this convention better than her. So youtube.com/Matt Binder for that. And if you want to support the show, you can, and whatever I do, you go to patreon.com/Matt Binder. And with that, I think we'll be going to the members fun half part of the show.
We are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerkey's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerkey.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. 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 A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black. Black, black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Cannot hustle.
Come on.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.